You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Montclair. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One, Monocle 24, with me, Ted Kravitz. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be asking whether French forces should be letting African troops lead operations in Mali, and we'll have the latest from the ground in the Malian capital, Bamako.
France is up against a formidable enemy, an enemy that's well-armed, well-equipped, well-trained, and have a very defined military strategy that France has yet to decipher, it seems.
Back in Europe, political violence is on the rise in Greece. We'll discover which groups and what institutions are in the firing line and to what effect. And fancy a quick nap. We'll find out how sleep tourism, that's taking a holiday to really knuckle down to some serious kip, is finding new popularity in chilly Lapland. Also on Midori House, we find out how to follow up one of the most fated Scandinavian cultural exports of recent years, TV show The Killing, and we'll be asking if a movie needs American box office success to be a commercial hit. All to come over the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up with the latest world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
Syria's government has today authorised the World Food Programme to extend its reach in the war-torn country, where 2.5 million people are suffering from hunger. The WFP executive director, Erathin Cousin, said they need to feed far more people.
Last week we were given a list of 110 additional NGOs that we can now work with that will give us the ability to scale up to another million persons. We have set a new target of 2.5 million. We are working with these partners to provide them with the resources so that they can help us distribute.
The bodies of the three Kurdish activists shot dead last week in France have now arrived in Istanbul before being flown to mainly Kurdish southeast Turkey for funeral ceremonies. Thousands of Kurds gathered outside Istanbul's Atatürk airport awaiting the coffins, chanting pro-Kurdistan Workers' Party slogans and carrying pictures of the women who were killed in their Paris office. The Irish Prime Minister, Enda Kenny, said it would be a catastrophe if Britain exited the European Union during his visit to the European Parliament in Strasbourg today. He made the visit on the occasion of the six-month Irish EU presidency, which began at the beginning of this month.
I cannot see renegotiations for any country in the time ahead. You're going to have European elections next year, a new commission, and it may well be that down the road, in the context of deeper integration of Europe, you may well have to have further treaties, and there's a process to be gone through there. So I do hope that, far be it from me to advise the British government as to what they want to do, but in my view, it would simply be catastrophic for Europe if Britain were to leave.
More than 35 people have died in a suicide attack and other bombings in northern Iraq and the capital Baghdad today, worsening sectarian strife as Prime Minister Nouria Maliki faces mounting pressure from minority Sunni Muslims and Kurds. Police at the Kenyan coast have seized 2 tons of ivory worth $1.15 million, the biggest haul on record in the East African country. Heavily armed poachers are killing elephants for their tusks and rhinos for their horns, which are used for ornaments and folk medicines. Kenya Wildlife Services Director William Kiprono blames the rise in poaching on the demand from Far East countries.
The price of ivory and rhino horn continues to rise by day, leading to increased poaching of elephants and rhinos. Economic growth in the Far East and Southeast Asian countries has increased demand for natural resources, including an increased demand for wildlife and wildlife products.
And finally, 80 players are taking part in the 34th Snow Golf Cup in snow-covered Silvoplana in Switzerland. The tournament is held on a 9-hole course, with each hole measuring 120 metres to 180 metres in length. Usual rules apply, although the holes are much bigger than regular cups. One concession in an otherwise very highly demanding event. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Sounds intriguing. Jonathan, thank you very much. And Jonathan, we'll be back with the headlines at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljat, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And first on Midori House, to Mali, and after the airstrikes come the ground troops. French special forces have today taken to their armoured vehicles and moved from the town of Niono, some 190 miles from the capital Bamako, towards rebel positions. But the key interventions could be from African troops in the days to come, fast-tracked into the area. West African military chiefs met for a second day in Bamako to hammer out how to realise their aim of deploying a 2,000-strong emergency force as early as the end of this week. In a moment, we'll hear from the editor of Think Africa Press about the prospects for a successful African military mission. But first, here's Reuters' Joe Penny with the latest from the Malian capital.
French troops have begun their first real major ground offensive in the town of Djabali, which is about 400 kilometers north of Bamako and 120 kilometers from Ségou. Today, the Malian president visited French soldiers at an airbase in Bamako and thanked them for helping Mali defeat quote-unquote terrorists. So there's still a lot of support among the Malian population for this French-backed war. It's a bit too early to tell how successful they're doing. I haven't heard a report yet back that they've taken back Djabali, so that's not yet taken back. The jihadists are still in the town of Kona. That's not yet taken back. And earlier this morning, jihadists managed to kidnap 40-plus foreign nationals from southern Algeria while at the same time holding two fronts in southern Mali. So I would say that France is up against a formidable enemy, an enemy that's well-armed, well-equipped, well-trained, and have a very defined military strategy that France has yet to decipher, it seems. There's no ECOWAS troops have arrived yet. 200 will be arriving tomorrow. They're from Nigeria. France is going it alone at this point. A lot of countries have pledged troops, but so far none have arrived, and they're not very well-trained. They're not very well-equipped. France has to take this one itself, it seems, at the moment.
Joe Penny from the news agency Reuters talking to us shortly before we came on air from Bamako. Well, tell us more is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. James, would you agree with Joe there that the French have to take the lead on this?
Yes, I think he's absolutely correct. There are large group of countries and bodies who've been planning some form of intervention for a number of months, but France was the only one of the large number of groups, West African regional forces, Malian army, other NATO allies and so on, who was able to act quickly and decisively over this weekend and the beginning of this week.
So why then are we seeing this gathering of, for example, troops from Niger on the border, and there is a keenness, almost against the clock, to get African troops into the arena?
Well, this was always the plan. The dispute between mainly France and the United States was to do with time frame, and it looks like what we're getting is the French intervention plan, although it's been done in a more ad hoc manner than I think they would have liked if the Americans had backed their time frame. And this is the intervention plan, which was apparently called CRAP by Susan Rice. And the idea that this intervention is meant to be African-led is deep-seated in both French and French and West African ideas, and also those of the United States.
What do we know of the ECOWAS troops? Are they well trained, well mobilized?
Not really, no. Most experts have said that they're pretty poorly trained, and really the September or October timeframe, which is what was previously being aimed for, was far more realistic in terms of getting those troops up to scratch.
Okay, but they do have more conflict experience in the region than the French troops, surely?
Well, It depends what you mean. I mean, they've got conflict experience in Sierra Leone and Liberia, which is extremely different territory to what they'll face in northern Mali. I mean, some of the French troops did fight in Afghanistan, which the terrain obviously is different, but is perhaps more similar to that of northern Mali than Sierra Leone and Liberia's. France also has troops stationed in Chad. Some of these troops that have come across were in Chad. Again, that's probably more similar than what ECOWAS troops have done beforehand.
Okay, well, whichever the troops are, whether they're from ECOWAS or the French, face, as we heard from Joe Penny there, a formidable military enemy. What are we talking about in terms of time frames? How conscious do all the troops and the commanders have to be on climactic conditions, weather conditions?
Extremely. And this is part of the reason why the original plan that was being worked to was for September. March and April are going to be extremely hot and very difficult to fight. This is part of the reason why François Hollande and Laurent Fabius, the French foreign minister, have been talking about this being a matter of weeks, because really a matter of weeks is all they have until they have to scale down the operation.
Indeed. So you can understand their keenness to get on. Just as somebody who sort of looks at this region from afar, albeit, how do you see progress so far? How have you assessed what the French are doing now that they don't seem to have spent very long on airstrikes before ground troops start to move in? But I guess time is of the essence.
I think that's true. I think this could be described as an ad hoc intervention. There's quite a lot of making up as it as the French go along. And I agree, as Joe said, that they're yet to decipher exactly what they are facing. And it looks like they faced fiercer resistance than they thought they originally would, just judging by the fact that they originally sent 800 troops and then very quickly raised that to 2,500.
And just briefly, as a result, of course, the refugee crisis continues to intensify and deteriorate.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the real concern, and this has been the real problem with not having firm plans and a lack of knowledge, is it's unknown precisely what effect any intervention and what the different sorts of intervention would have on internally displaced people, refugee flows, problems of malnutrition. And before the Tuareg uprising, which set this whole chain of events off, happened at the beginning of last year, northern Mali was already faced with severe drought and large-scale malnutrition. And this is only adding to those problems.
Okay. James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, thank you very much. In a moment on Midori House, David Gardner of the Financial Times will be joining us to explore the current state of the relationship between the Turkish government and the Kurdish party, the PKK, and their peace talks.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York, and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand, or any brand for that matter, is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
Fourteen minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House. Now, it's one of the enduring civil conflicts left in Greater Europe and the surroundings. The long-running and usually violent conflict between the Turkish state and the Kurdish People's Party, or PKK, turned bloody again last week. Three Kurdish women activists were murdered in Paris just as peace talks are getting underway on neutral ground in Oslo. Well, the Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan has suggested the killings could be the result of an internal feud in the PKK, or war and also a bid to derail the peace talks. Nonetheless, he's promised the discussions will continue. Well, the Financial Times International Affairs editor David Gardner joins us on the line from Beirut. David, who was identified amongst the dead in Paris?
I think the target was clearly the co-founder of the PKK, along with Abdullah Öcalan, Bekin Caniz. And I think the two women that were with her were pretty much circumstantial. She was a delegate, and Öcalan's confidant to the Oslo peace talks, although those talks have now moved up a gear and are taking place directly with Öcalan, who is in prison in an island off Istanbul, and the counterparty for the Turkish state is essentially their top security people, including their spy chief Hakan Fidan.
So a murder, a triple murder indeed, on foreign soil is pretty much par for the course for the way this very bloody and nasty dispute has gone along the many years between the PKK and the Turkish government, the state.
Yeah, I mean, it has been a vicious dispute. It's now, you know, coming close to three decades. It really kicked off in 1984. On the whole, they have avoided, unlike, for example, the sort of tit-for-tat attacks between the Israelis and various Palestinian and Arab opponents, they have generally avoided, you know, fighting this out on foreign soil. It's been confined to the sort of, you know, the borderlands of southeast Turkey and so on and so forth. This is probably an expansion, and it probably reflects the fact that this may be the closest we have come to actually getting a solution to this problem.
Okay, well, let's talk about that solution. What kind of a delicate balance, or how delicate, does the Prime Minister need to tread on this?
Very. I mean, you know, Turks have it sort of seared into their consciousness that, you know, with the fall of the Ottoman Empire, predatory European powers tried to break up Turkey. They had, in effect, to fight a war of independence to found their republic. And any question, the mere mention any challenge to the integrity and authority of that republic is anathema to the vast majority of Turks. The current government of the neo-Islamist AK Party, the Justice and Development Party of Tayyip Erdogan, has been the first to acknowledge, really, that Turkey has a Kurdish question. They broke a taboo. They recognize that the Kurds, we don't have an accurate figure for how many, but it's probably in the region of about 15 million Kurds inside Turkey. They have to, the Turkish state needs to move to acknowledge their linguistic and cultural rights and to devolve a degree of self-government. But even so, they've blown hot and cold on this. They are terrified of an ultra-nationalist backlash, and these killings could be that. It is one of the paradoxes of modern Turkey that even though Erdogan and his party have been in power for 10 years, re-elected twice with a rising share of the vote and so on, but they still continue to behave almost as though they were in the opposition, and above all on this question.
Do you give Erdogan any credit, though, for having the fortitude to actually tackle this issue?
No, I certainly do. I think Erdogan believes that sectarianism and, you know, broadly speaking, the minority question is the primary threat
to the future of the entire region, and Turkish hopes, as it were, for leadership of that region. It's also the case that in the past 2 years, arguably in the past 10 years, with all the upheavals in the Arab countries, this has moved the furniture for the Kurds, spread out over about four countries, in the most radical way since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. Mm. And with the civil war in Syria, we are about to see the severest test of the post-Ottoman borders. We already have a self-government in northern Iraq of the Iraqi Kurds, the Kurdistan Regional Government. They have helped spread Kurdish autonomy to northeast Syria, taking advantage of the civil war there. And clearly, this for many Turks looks like the sudden spread of Kurdish agitation, leading to a sort of a drive for a pan-Kurdish homeland, which might bite a chunk out of southeast Turkey. So it requires an enormous amount of courage to do this. And I mean, Erdogan has been telling people over the past 6 to 9 months that he actually wants to solve this question within the framework of possibly a new constitution in Turkey. So it does require a great deal of courage, yes.
Mm, it's a fascinating topic in an equally fascinating region. But thank you very much for your insight there, David Gardner, from the Financial Times. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be heading over to Greece in just a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
22 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, with record high unemployment and painful austerity measures in place in Greece, it's no surprise that there's deep-seated anger towards the government's programme of fiscal reform. But a series of attacks on government buildings and institutions are raising new fears over the rise and frequency of politically motivated violence. To find out why and how the government are responding, we're joined now in the studio by Constantine Bouhaye, journalist and author. Constantine, nice to have you join us again here on Monocle 24. Just tell us, run us through some of these attacks on government institutions, buildings. What are we seeing?
Basically, these are homemade, improvised explosives with which you attach to a gas canister. You put it against someone's door, you put it in institutions, and then they explode. They are usually non-lethal, but they seem to be quite easy to make. Don't try them at home, because even though they are non-lethal, they can blind you and give you severe burning. And there's the rise in anarchy and in student activity, rather militant student activity and anarchist activity, means that more and more people are learning this trade. The question is, are they just letting off some steam, or are they terrorists in the making? And that is the big concern.
Mm, yes, indeed. And have the police, as a first question, started to detect any trends in these attacks?
It's always the same pattern. It's new groups that are emerging with, I'll give you some of the names. Zero Tolerance is one group who has carried out such attacks. Fighting Minorities, another. The latest one is Lovers of Lawlessness. The pattern is the same. They haven't used stronger explosives. I'll give you an example of what it means to actually be targeting someone. There was the editor of a blog 2 years ago, They rang his doorbell. He went downstairs to open the door. They lured him outside and they gunned him down. When you want to kill someone, you lure them, you gun them down. This is not happening, thank God, thank goodness. Mm. But will we reach that stage or not? The other trend is before, there used to be a very major terrorist group in Greece called November 17. Mm. It assassinated about 23 people. The authorities were doing nothing. No one was talking about it. Now, with these attacks, the climate has changed. These attacks have become part of the political discourse, and those attacks are used by one party to attack another party as if the other party is complicit in those attacks.
But are we seeing some kind of new wave of political violence? Are these people who are doing this maybe younger? Are they motivated by different ways?
They certainly do seem to be younger. The latest proclamation by one of them, it uses, before, when they used to write proclamations, it was lengthy sort of Marxist-Leninist discourse. You couldn't really understand what was going on. The language they're using nowadays for their proclamations is blogger, Twitter type. It's short sentences with a bit of humor thrown into it. So this indicates that they are much younger, probably early 20s.
The attack on journalists also is quite alarming.
Yes. It's alarming, though, again, as I said, non-lethal. If one of those devices went off in your front door, the glass would break and there would be a scorch marks on your door. The worrying thing is, even though it's non-lethal, is it a warning? Is it telling them this is a first taster, there's more coming if you do not pull the line?
Hmm. What do we know of how some of these attacks are being viewed by those in average Greek society who, while they may sympathise clearly with the state that everybody is in Greece, might be quite alarmed themselves in methods that are being deployed?
I think not. The pattern in Greece is, unlike Spain, Ireland, other countries, is to target in a non-lethal way or to target someone and kill them down. They do not place bombs or do not carry out shootouts in the middle of crowds. Mm. This means that the population has kept a fairly strong level of indifference towards those incidents.
Now, we've been talking presumably about Athens, have we, these attacks? Or
indeed.
Have we seen in anything in Thessaloniki or anything outside the capital?
There have been in Thessaloniki, but nothing to the scale of Athens. Athens is where you have the big multinationals, where these things go off. Mm. This is where you have the political figures. This is where you have the ex-ministers. Athens is the main target. Mm.
Okay, so what are we expecting to see? What would the government be doing next and the police be thinking next as their next move? Just sort of crossing their fingers and hoping that they don't start to actually kill some people?
Apart from investigation, one would hope that they have penetrated with intelligence those groups and they can have inside information. This would have been a logical step carried out by the authorities. Obviously, we don't know if this has happened. And certainly there have been no arrests and therefore, or no major arrests. Therefore, one must assume that if there is intelligence, if the police have infiltrated their ranks, they are certainly not learning anything about it. Therefore, we can expect more of the same.
Okay, well, alarming to hear, but anyway, we will follow that with interest. Constantine Bohea, often very well-known and Monocle contributor, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monaco 24.
Ot London, tu é Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette é Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
We're just getting towards the bottom of the hour, and in the next half hour of Midori House, our culture editor Rob Bound sheds some light on how to produce the next TV show, The Killing, We hear from our Copenhagen correspondent, Michael Booth, as well about his interview with the producer of the renowned Danish series. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Syria's government has today authorised the World Food Programme to extend its reach in the war-torn country where 2.5 million people are suffering from hunger. The bodies of three Kurdish activists shot dead last week in France have now arrived in Istanbul before being flown to mainly Kurdish southeast Turkey for funeral ceremonies. The Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny said it would be a catastrophe if Britain exited the European Union during his visit to the European Parliament in Strasbourg today. He made the visit on the occasion of the six-month Irish EU presidency, which began at the beginning of this month. More than 35 people have died in a suicide attack and other bombings in northern Iraq, worsening sectarian strife as Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki faces mounting pressure from minority Sunni Muslims and Kurds. And police at the Kenyan coast have seized 2 tons of ivory worth over $1 million, the biggest haul on record in the East African country. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time is just coming up for 18:31 here in London. Now, struggling from insomnia and desperate to cut loose, strike off and enjoy a holiday? Well, Finland has just the thing. Sleep tourism. Apparently it's on the rise, this at least according to the Finns, who've now launched a research project at the University of Lapland. In a rather straight-faced manner, the university says that their study provides alternative perspectives for the development of Arctic tourist resorts and the sustainable use of natural environments. That's to get some much-needed kip, while our own Finnish night owl Markus Hippi spoke to Anu Valtonen of Lapland University about exactly how much sleep can help the tourism industry there.
In order to give us a better understanding of what sleep tourism is all about, could you give us examples of what is going on with sleep tourism around the world?
Sleep tourism is a type of tourism in which sleep and rest provide the key source of experience and pleasure instead of the active attractions or active activities. So it means that people go to a special place to have a great sleep, which means that they can go to snow hotels, ice igloos, caves, or to hotels that are situated in trees. Or on the other hand, they can also go to places such as sleep cafes, which have been emerged around the cities around the world.
That all sounds really interesting. What do you have going on in Lapland at the moment?
Well, in Lapland, we have these many sleep services, which means that we have snow hotels, igloos.
So what is basically the point? I kind of understand the fascination of going to a nice hotel and, you know, spending some time in igloo, but when you sleep, you're not exactly aware of what's going on around you. So what are the people actually looking for in terms of sleep?
Well, they're looking for the surroundings, which are exotic and aesthetically rewarding, but also in terms of sleep, they want to wake up refreshed.
Sleep tourism is one part of a research project called New Sleep Order that you have at the University of Lapland. What exactly do you research?
We are researching the change which is happening or going on around sleep, because there is much happening around the sleep at the moment in Western countries. There is a whole new sleep market emerging, which offers new types of products and services for people.
How could you imagine Lapland benefiting from all this sleep tourism in the future? What makes Lapland special?
Lapland offers a very unique environment in terms of its nature. We are situated in the Arctic Circle, which means that we have four seasons. So we have dark periods and light periods, using this kind of notion of lightscape, so that we can really enjoy of sleeping during wintertime when it's dark, or vice versa. And also the other point is that as we have more reindeers than people in Lapland, which means that this is a silent environment, special and unique.
And what kind of new services could you imagine seeing in Lapland in the future?
Well, new product, new types of places in which to sleep, but also those sleep services that we offer, personal trainers.
And what do they do?
They help people sleep well.
And how can they do that? What kind of advice can they offer?
They offer relaxation techniques, that how you can fall asleep, how you should sleep, what kind of diet you should have so as you can sleep better and so on.
Could you give us more examples of what you can imagine seeing in the future in Lapland? You already mentioned, I know that Lapland has some ice hotels, and you may have an igloo or two, but I don't think you have caves. I don't think you have hotels in trees yet. Could you imagine seeing something like that or something else that's new in Lapland in the future?
Yes. In the Arctic area, there are many kinds of examples, like hotels in trees, but perhaps also we are going to invent something for the summer. Because nowadays, most of our products and services are focused on wintertime tourism. So perhaps this sleeping with mosquitoes would be some kind of survival game.
Anu Valtonen, you really don't make that sound very appealing to me. I know the mosquitoes. You absolutely can't sleep if there's even one of them in the room. How does that work together with the idea of good sleep?
That's kind of extraordinary experiences, which means that they are not only pleasurable, but it's also something that you really experience. Because there are many people who go for trekking, for instance. They live and cope with mosquitoes, and it's one part of the experience, like the local people do. We live here with mosquitoes.
I can imagine Lapland tourism working during the winter when it's absolutely dark in there, but during the summer when basically the sun can be shining the day around 24/7, and there, as you mentioned, are mosquitoes. Do you think that through this research you could actually come up with new ideas and offer them to Lapland to give them some kind of an idea of new services that they could maybe go and launch?
Yeah, that's one of our points. And also that we are studying an investigation the way local people historically and traditionally have coped with those rhythm of seasons and nature. And then we think that how can these be perhaps offered for people who come here? Because, for instance, during summertime, like you mentioned, there is light all day long, which means that you can follow the rhythm of your own body and of your own needs when you make the rhythm of how to sleep, when to wake. The people who come here during summertime for trekking, for fishing, for hunting, that's what they do. They can go for and live and rhythm, make their rhythm according to their own body. We are so used to this clock time and dark and light. So we can offer a whole new rhythm for people.
That sounds really good. Where is the biggest market for sleep tourism at the moment? Where do the people come from who come to Lapland to sleep?
Asia is an emerging market, Russian as well. People who come for honeymoon, they come for something extraordinary, like spending wedding night at ice hotel.
And presumably having a nice kip afterwards. Anu Valtonen there of Lapland University speaking to Marco Sippi. We'll be back in just a moment with a bit of music and a hint on how to follow up a killer TV show.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalising the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
Montclair. Keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
Thirty-eight minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House. This is Ben Westbeach now with Let Your Feelings Show. Ben Westbeach, originally trained as a cellist and from Bristol, but now living in London there with Let Your Feelings Show. 42 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. Now, in the latest edition of Monocle magazine, we speak to the people at the sharp end of their industries, and we've been extending that idea here on Monocle 24 this week in our how-to section. Today, how do you follow up on one of the most celebrated Scandinavian cultural exports of recent years, specifically TV show The Killing? In a moment, we'll be hearing from our man in Copenhagen, Michael Booth, who interviewed the show's producer for the current issue, and will be soliciting our current culture editor, Rob Bound. Hello, Rob.
Howdy.
Soliciting in a good way.
your
views. But first, let's hear from The Killing's creator, Søren Sveistrup, on the challenge of sustaining a success.
When the second series was showed in Denmark, everything exploded in abroad. And so the expectations, they were very high now to the third series. And how do you cope with that? Well, actually, I couldn't work. I mean, I blew it. I worked maybe for half a year and I couldn't take any decisions. I was really, really handicapped by this pressure. I thought, oh, wow. Whatever I do, it's not good enough. It won't suit the British or the Germans or, you know, whatever. And then it went very fast. Then I had to believe in my stomach feeling, and we wrapped up the story very fast, and then we said, okay, this is good. This is good enough. And it took me a while, and it took the producer and director to say action in the studio before I really moved forward, before I really just, you know, took my head off and just, okay, let's just do what we usually do.
Okay, so before we cross to Copenhagen, Rob, the answer to the question seems like you don't really follow up after you have a sort of crisis of confidence in yourself.
Yeah, it's a tough thing, isn't it? I mean, this is something that'd be interesting to ask Michael about as well, just how surprised Danmarks Radio, the producers of The Killing, the original, obviously, Danish Killing, were when they had this hit on their hands, and how completely eminently transportable and exportable it was, not just to the Brits and the Germans, but, you know, for a Hollywood remake and all the rest of it.
Okay, well, Michael was very successful as far as the Hollywood remake goes. What's the view on the original Killing in Denmark?
Well, they were all, everyone connected with these programs, Born, also the political drama and The Killing and The Bridge. They've all been shocked time and time again by the international success of these series. They see them very much as parochial Danish interests, and they were absolutely baffled, especially, I think, by Born, the political drama, that has been so successful internationally. But they're incredibly proud. You know, these shows go out at 8 o'clock on Sunday nights and attract regularly 40-50% of the audience, like 2 million people, which is half of the country, in fact. So they're very proud. They're massively successful here, but they're still a little bit perplexed by why they're so successful abroad.
And you spoke to the producer of The Killing for the current issue of Monocle. What did she say about a follow-up?
Yeah, her name is Pil Berndt, and she's co-head of drama at Danmarks Radio. She's had a hand in Born, The Killing, and The Bridge, and won international BAFTAs and Emmys. And, of course, they plan a couple of years in advance. So they were starting to prepare the Killing's replacement a couple of years ago. And it's going to be something completely different. They're fed up of crime series, and now it's going to be a family drama called The Legacy, about four siblings dealing with the death of their artist mother, set in the very idyllic, pretty Danish island of Funen. Now, I asked Pil Berndt if this means that's the end of Nordic noir as far as DR is concerned, but she said no, they're going to be coming back again, planning 2 years ahead in about 2015. They're looking now for a male crime detective kind of figure to replace Sara Lund, because there will be no more of The Killing, unfortunately. So Sara Lund is finished, but in a couple of years we can look forward to another Danish detective, I think.
Interesting stuff to come then. And Nordic noir, Rob, has proved to be massively successful in all its guises.
Well, exactly. And I think it's the thing of not wanting to sort of be completely unsentimental about the beauty and craft of these Danish programmes, but there is something wonderful about a subtitle that certainly gets it to meet its kind of core constituent audience on BBC TV here in the UK. But I wanted to ask Michael about the sort of unsentimental nature of Pil Berndt and the producers at Danmarks Radio, taking very much a long view, Michael, something that maybe the UK TV or US TV wouldn't do. There'd be maybe eight series of The Killing already, and there'd be sort of all sorts of, maybe a bit, there'd be a Sara Lund action figures in the Danish equivalent of McDonald's, right?
Yeah, Yeah, you know, in America they would flog it to death, wouldn't they? There would be, you know, 8-10 series of this. But no, they called it a day. I think Stern Zweistrup, the writer, was very, very adamant about that, and he's keen to move on to new things. But in the newspapers here yesterday, there was a very interesting story that HBO, the American TV network that's brought us things like The Sopranos and Game of Thrones, they're now talent spotting in Denmark at the moment. And Pil Bernt from DR has been over in New York talking to them about co-producing American Scandinavian series set in America. That's how hot these series have become in America now. The hottest TV drama channel in the world is now coming to Copenhagen to find talent. I think that's amazing.
It's like the bridge that bridges Copenhagen and Lund, I suppose, or Malmo, is going to have to stretch to make it over to New York City, right?
Yeah, I don't know how they're going to have a body across the border there. That's going to be a bit tricky, yeah. But, I mean, we've seen this before with that Norwegian series, the Norwegian crime series, the name of which escapes me recently, which is quite a big hit. Comedy drama in which a mafia boss is relocated to a remote Norwegian town. I think we can expect to see more of that with a kind of token big-name American in Copenhagen. So, I don't know. Who can we expect to see? Tom Hanks in Copenhagen in the next few weeks?
Anything is possible. Just a wider sort of question to both of you, really. I mean, we heard earlier about the sort of creative trauma that you might go through. Where is the next creative spark going to come from? Especially if you're being paid, you know, money to come up with the next idea, the next big idea, and, you know, how to make the next big series. Do you think we're looking at maybe a move back rather than sort of flogging these kind of horses to creatives going away? Maybe like sort of the way Fawlty Towers, they only made two series of that, and yeah, people love it because of it, to actually let's only do a small amount, leave people wanting a bit more. Or do you think the commercial reasons are that, you know, they're always going to make extended episodes of whatever is a TV hit?
Well, I think in terms of DR, they're not under such commercial pressure, actually. They have a kind of different remit, which is in part public sector. So what's been important with all of these series is that they have some kind of message about society, and there's something a bit beneath just a plot-driven device or even just character. There's something deeper. And they have that freedom because they're state-funded. And I think that's a big advantage that they would have over someone like HBO. And it would be interesting to see whether HBO have the patience for, I don't know, issues to do with modern families and divorce and women's rights and those kind of things, which are important to Danes.
Yeah, I'd just say to conclude maybe as well that maybe it's seen in the US that if you only do two series of a show and it's a hit show, then you've kind of failed, despite the fact it might have got record viewing figures and it might have been critically applauded. You know, it's maybe not in the DNA for some reason. Mm. And as Michael said, Danmark's Radio is obviously a public broadcaster, and they presumably have a different responsibility, and they probably have more of a responsibility to break talent and be interesting than simply to kind of wring something dry, I guess.
Okay, thank you very much. Michael Booth in Copenhagen and our culture editor, Rob Bound. Coming up on a similar theme, does a movie need to be a Hollywood hit to be a commercial success? You're listening to Midori House. Now, you might have imagined that a human interest drama about a family living through and then separated in the aftermath of the Boxing Day tsunami would be right up Hollywood's boulevard. But The Impossible, starring Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor, has failed to pull in the numbers so far in American markets. The movie has done rather better here in Europe, breaking records in Spain where it was produced, and is doing rather well in the box offices from Brazil to Japan to the UK. To tell us more about this and whether it matters that it's not doing so well in the States, we welcome to our studio regular movie supremo, Karen Krizanovich. I can just about get that out. Karen, hi.
Hi there.
Now, a quick précis of the film. We've said it's about the Boxing Day tsunami. Indeed, you watch maybe the first 20 minutes of it, and it's like any kind of disaster movie. You know what's coming next. Does that in any way kind of ruin it? You're watching this family having a nice time, and you're thinking, I know what's coming. They don't.
Of course, it's not called The Tsunami. So in a way, the less you know about this film, as with most films, the better off you're going to be. We went to see the Titanic, too, and we knew it was going to happen. But the wonderful thing about The Impossible is that, yes, it is about a family trapped in the Boxing Day tsunami in Thailand. That is true. But that's pretty much where it stops, your awareness and your knowledge of what this movie is going to do to you. Mm. It's unlike any other film I've ever seen.
Why?
Insofar as it is almost experiential. You almost feel inundated yourself because it is shot in such an amazing way that you empathize with everything that's happening to the whole family. Now, it's been criticized as being a film that, oh, it only tells the story of this one family and it doesn't show any of the disaster hitting the Thai people and it doesn't bring in other strands of story. Well, it does peripherally, and I think that those are quite unfair criticisms, but director Juan Antonio Bayona is primarily known for his horror work. He did a lot of shorts and videos before, but his film The Orphanage is considered a pretty good horror film. I don't watch horror films, so I haven't seen it. Mm. But taking this story, which was it's about a Spanish family. I think they're called Bellón. It's made by a Spanish director with Spanish money, made partially in Spain and in Thailand. Mm. It's very emotional. That's the best way I can put it. It is going to melt the hardest heart, this film.
So the question is then, or at least the question we're asking when we look at it, is why perhaps it hasn't done too well in the States. Do you think it's maybe a matter of timing? Maybe people aren't feeling particularly like they want to be taken through the emotional mill in the States in their movie theaters, and maybe aren't going to see it for that reason.
Well, I think marketing has a lot to do with it. I mean, this film was marketed very, very heavily to the Spanish market almost a year before it came out. There's also a lot of interest in Spanish-speaking countries, and I don't know whether it was in English or if it was dubbed in those areas. But Americans often shy away from anything that doesn't smack of being a domestic film. Mm. I know that sounds ridiculous. But I would say that it's primarily a marketing thing because Americans like a good story as much as the rest of us. I think there's a lack of awareness about this movie, and hopefully Naomi Watts' an Oscar nomination for it will bring more people to watch it.
Well, indeed, and because, you know, they haven't gone there, at least they've got Naomi Watts well-known, even though she's Antipodean, Australian, and Ewan McGregor, they haven't made it too Spanish.
No, absolutely not. And there was some discussion of why weren't there Spanish actors in this. The film needed funding. So you need to get at the biggest names that you can in order to bring in finance. And even directors like somebody like Jodie Foster has trouble getting their directing projects off the ground money-wise. I do think that there is a shying away, too, of true stories. I think Americans sometimes see true stories as being a bit twee, and they want more fantasy because they've had a lot of fantasy. They want that sort of shoveled on. I think what's really interesting about this film, particularly in its Spanish market, is that, okay, the Spanish cinema-going audience has dropped because of the terrible economic conditions there. Mm. But as in the Depression and as in parts of India, when people really are strapped for money, they go to the cinema because it gets them out of the house. And it is one of the most uplifting experiences you can have. You're inundated. You can't think of anything else but the story in front of you. And I think the secret to the impossible is that no matter how bad your life is, their life is worse.
Indeed. I mean, can you think of other movies maybe that have been hits, certainly in European territories or Asian territories, and not so much in the US? Does it even matter? Does it need to be pulling in the money from Hollywood anymore in order to be a success, both for its producers and critically?
That's a very, very good point. They're saying now that The Impossible is a new business model, whereas they can, this is going to sound ridiculous, but get a good story, have a good script.
Always helps.
Make it in a good way. I mean, Bayona didn't just use CGI. He said in one interview, anybody that just uses CGI is lazy. Mm. He also used models, which are fantastic, and shot in a tank in Alicante. And it's so realistic. You look and there's no uncanny valley because he didn't use CGI that much. Mm. But the notion of a good story going global is one of the reasons why, let's say, Hollywood bought The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and remade it. Mm. Why they took something like Let the Right One In and remade it. a good story is something that Hollywood wants to get its hands on and, well, usually mess up.
Okay. Well, hopefully, as you say, it will get a little more attention with the Oscar nom. Just one more thing. If we are ourselves haven't seen it and are going to go and see it, do we need to bring the Kleenex?
Oh, yes. Bring Kleenex if you're a woman or if you wear mascara, waterproof mascara. If you're ashamed of crying, don't bring anybody that is going to make fun of you while you bawl your eyes out, because you will. I've seen it twice. And I bawled like a broken egg both times.
Okay, brilliant. Karen Krusanovic, as ever, thank you very much for coming in. You're listening to Midori House. And that is, unfortunately, all we have time for today. Our producer was Alad John, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager Chris Fitch. Next is our business show, The Entrepreneurs, here on Monocle 24, where we'll be hearing from Ben McKinnon, a man who's opened up his own bakery making artisan sourdough bread in nowhere less than East London.
It just makes a high street so much more interesting if there's something a little bit kind of quirky or unusual and, you know, something great that's being produced. And I think bakeries are a really exciting place for that.
In 3 hours' time, 2200 hours here in London, Marcos Hippie and Andrew Muller will be back live with the Monocle Daily. Louise Beale will be back with Midori House, same time, same place tomorrow. But for me, Ted Kravitz, for now, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.